learn how to use them consciously and to your advantage. There's a body of research that explores another theory of personality called Personality Systems Interactions, PSI. This theory focuses on how individuals cope in times of stress. Based on a continuum of behavior, it distinguishes between those who are action-oriented and those who are state-oriented. People who are action-oriented are good at emotional regulation, can summon up positive images of self under fire, and don't rely on external cues. Yes, this sounds like the skill set of a securely attached person who's motivated by approach goals. The perspective and the vocabulary are different. In contrast, people who demonstrate state-oriented behavior flood with emotion under stress, don't self-regulate well, are preoccupied with worries about failing, and are sensitive to external cues. This description is also similar to the traits of an insecurely attached person motivated by avoidance. This theory also assumes that these dispositions are learned in childhood. Now, back to primes. In one experiment, after filling out questionnaires that determined either their action or state orientation, half of the participants were asked to visualize a difficult and demanding person in their lives and to recall both specific incidents and how they felt at the time. In other words, they were asked to hot process the encounters. Then, additionally, the experimenters had these participants write down those observations and identify the difficult person by his or her initials. The other half of the participants were asked to do the same things, but focusing on visualizing, naming, and writing about an accepting person in their lives and how they felt. Then, everyone was tested on how quickly they could identify a schematicized image of a discrepant face in a crowd, a happy face in a field of angry ones, for example. Then they were asked to identify or not identify, noting me or not me, with a series of positive, reliable, creative, etc., and negative, impulsive, etc., traits. Even after visualizing a difficult person and encounters, the action-oriented people could pick out a happy face in a crowd and identify with positive traits. The priming didn't affect them. The researchers hypothesized that the unconscious, self-affirming processes of the action-oriented deactivated the primes. Not surprisingly, the state-oriented were affected by priming a difficult relationship, couldn't pick out happy faces, and felt more negative about themselves. Not surprisingly, negative priming makes all the deficits of state orientation worse. Stop and think for a moment whether this is the case for you. Does stress make you feel worse about yourself, or are you able to rise to the occasion and pull down positive self-images? Now, to the other half of the experiment, visualizing an accepting person. Interestingly, action-oriented people weren't affected by visualizing an accepting person either, but, and here's the important part, state-oriented people not only felt better after visualizing a calm relationship, but also identified with more positive traits. And this wasn't the only experiment to show that positive primes might help someone who was normally brought low by negative cues. The takeaway? Visualizing someone who accepts you in times of stress will increase your ability to manage the situation. Exploring the power of primes. Research suggests that insecurely attached people, or using the other terminology, the state-oriented, can actually use priming to stabilize mood, self-soothe, and manage negative emotions more productively. For example, researchers Sander L. Kuhl and David Falkenberg had participants in an experiment either recall a stressful and demanding period in their lives in great detail or a calming and relaxing one. The researchers then primed the participants with an equal number of positive and negative words. As expected, The action-oriented dealt with the negative primes the way water glides off a duck's back. But the state-oriented, who focused on a calming time in their lives, were able to diffuse the effect of the negative primes better than the action-oriented. Just thinking about a happy period in their lives, fully visualizing it, helped them to regulate their emotions with more skill and to be less reactive to negative primes. Other research has explored how insecure attachment styles can be altered. As you know, and researchers point out, your attachment style is informed by a single encounter with your caretaker, but many, many experiences over a long period of time, so that a single intervention or moment in time is unlikely to change it. That said, researchers continue to look at what can be done to change the unconscious reactions of the anxiously and avoidantly attached. One is earned attachment, which describes what happens when a person is in a relationship. It could be with a love interest, a therapist or mentor, or some other close person, which effectively breaks down those older mental representations and replaces them with ones of secure connection. We'll discuss that later. But first, let's examine how you can use priming in the day-to-day. While some experiments use primes, security and love-related words or scenarios, have changed participants' reactions in laboratory settings, the changes have been short-lived, lasting only hours. That was not the case in an experiment conducted by Catherine B. Carnelli and Angela C. Rowe, which found the effects of secure priming to last for days. They primed the participants by having them visualize someone with whom they felt secure, had them write about these individuals on two separate occasions, and also had them imagine a scenario in which they were helped by sensitive people when they confronted a problem they couldn't deal with on their own. In their discussion, the researchers note that simply thinking about secure interpersonal experiences may help everyone, regardless of their attachment style, when they are under stress. In my experience, that's certainly true. For the anxious or avoidant, recalling people and interactions in their lives that belied their primary experiences may strengthen these secure mental representations and make them more accessible. The hope is that, through repeated exposure, it's the image of secure attachment that comes to mind when a person reacts to or assesses a situation. Finally, though, the researchers acknowledge that, although repetitive priming of attachment security may change people's cognitions or thoughts about relationships and the self, it may be more difficult to change emotional reactions to the attachment stimuli. In blunt terms, that describes the unconscious hypervigilance of both the anxious and the avoidant and their automatic ways of coping. But those, too, can be disarmed over time with effort. The bottom line? Your ability to imagine and bring up images of the kind and caring people in your life into your thoughts can facilitate change. The takeaway lessons. Recognizing your triggers. Disarming your unconscious process is a battle to be fought on several fronts. Following are some potentially helpful strategies. Focus on your reactivity. Years ago, a therapist had these words of wisdom for me. Stop, look, listen. What he meant was that I had to focus and pay conscious attention to the situations that made me feel the way I did around my mother. Instead of allowing myself to go on autopilot, becoming defensive or reactive, I had to learn to step back and process not only what I was feeling, but also why. Use stop, look, listen as a mental timeout when you are becoming reactive and ask yourself the following questions. Am I reacting to something in the present, or has the present moment dredged up something out of my past? Keep in mind that words, tone, gestures, and body language can all act as triggers, blurring the line between the past and present. Am I seeing the situation clearly, or is my reactivity driving the car that's me? Am I listening to the intention behind the words, not just the words themselves? Giving yourself a wide enough berth to be able to examine both the source and nature of your feelings is particularly important for those of us who grew up looking through the wrong end of the binoculars. If you are having a physical response, heightened anxiety, a pounding heart, or fear, to a situation that isn't particularly threatening, it's entirely possible that your emotions are being hijacked by automatic processes. The only way to know is to give yourself a timeout, hit the pause button, and stop, look, listen. Pay attention to situational cues. Work on becoming aware of how you're being affected by the space you're in, along with the situation. It's normal to feel anxious, for example, when you go to the doctor, or irritated when you're standing in line at the bank, but it's key to get a bead on how you are triggered and by what. Ask yourself the following questions. Does my mood shift when I'm in a crowded room? In what ways? Do I get energized by being around people or exhausted? Do I tend to overreact to small annoyances and have trouble self-calming? Am I hypervigilant to small slights, especially those that echo my treatment in childhood? Someone calling me out on my version of events, for example, or telling me that I'm too sensitive. Alternatively, am I quick to withdraw or get defensive when there's tension or a glitch in communication? Writing down your observations in your journal using cool processing will also give you greater mastery over both your emotions and reactivity over time. All of these behaviors are learned in childhood and need to be consciously unlearned. Listen to your body. If you're starting to sweat, or your throat suddenly feels tight, or you have any other visceral response to a situation, see if you can trace those feelings back to a source or sources. Words or postures in what might seem to be an ordinary exchange to someone else, but that recall a childhood experience, might be triggering you. For example, when someone cuts me dead in mid-conversation, saying something like, "I don't want to talk about this now," or stonewalls by going silent, all of my buttons are automatically pushed because it's my childhood revisited. I have to consciously remind myself that my reaction is being heightened, beginning to untangle the unconscious responses you learned growing up from what are appropriate and measured responses to what's happening now is key to recovery. Use self-priming and visualization to increase your security. Follow the lead set by research findings by visualizing in times of stress secure connections, people, and places. Remember that securely attached people do this automatically and unconsciously. You can get the same effects by using conscious processing. Don't normalize abusive behavior. Daughters who experienced verbal abuse in childhood and were bullied, taunted, or gaslighted sometimes have trouble recognizing toxicity in adulthood. Your tendency to excuse or normalize abusive behavior is an important pattern to bring into consciousness so that you can get clear and immutable boundaries and recognize toxic behavior when you see it. If someone is using disparaging words or gestures, excuse yourself and practice stop, look, listen. You don't have to start World War III, and you need to say something like, "I'm taking a break now. We can continue this discussion when you don't feel the need to put me down." Setting boundaries is a matter of practice, and you will get used to doing it in time. Getting off the merry-go-round by recognizing more unconscious patterns. The more you know about the human brain and its special bag of tricks, the better you'll be at disarming unconscious patterns inherited from childhood. These habits of mind aren't limited to unloved daughters, of course, but they definitely stand in everyone's way when it comes to making good decisions, managing emotions successfully, and becoming happier with yourself and your life. For the unloved daughter, still struggling with the fallout from childhood, they are real stumbling blocks. Again, these are unconscious mental processes that can be disarmed by conscious recognition. Realizing the power of intermittent reinforcement. If you ever took an introductory psych course, you might remember an experiment involving three very hungry rats conducted by B.F. Skinner. But if you missed it, here's the scoop. Each cage holds a single rat and is equipped with a lever. In the first cage, when the rat pushes the lever, a food pellet is always delivered. Once the rat realizes that food is a sure thing, he loses interest in the lever and goes about his business until he's hungry. In the second cage, the lever has been disconnected, and when the rat pushes it, nothing happens. He pushes again and again, and the result is the same, and, not surprisingly, he loses interest in the lever. It's what happens in the third cage, though, that has a lesson for us. Sometimes the lever works and delivers the pellet, and sometimes it doesn't. It's a totally random pattern, but the intermittent delivery gets the rat totally fixated on the lever and increases his persistence. He'll keep on pushing. This is true of humans, too. Nothing makes us more persistent than getting what we want some of the time. Combine that with two other common habits of mind, recasting a loss as a near win and being overly optimistic, which humans are, and the chances are good that you are going to stay on the emotional carousel forever. Consider your relationship to your mother or anyone in your life who is disappointing you big time, and has been for ages, in terms of behavior, empathy, reciprocity, or anything else. And imagine a conversation or a meeting that goes much better than you expected and even makes you feel hopeful that things are about to change. Your inner optimist is smiling, and you're going to try harder because maybe this is the time things will finally turn around. That's intermittent reinforcement at work. Intermittent reinforcement keeps people at slot machines because winning now and again makes them believe that if they persist, they'll hit it big. It's especially true in relationships. When you get just a tiny taste of what you want, you're suddenly in it to win it even though nothing has really changed. It goes without saying that intermittent reinforcement keeps the dance of denial going and gets your hopes up, but also sets you up for second-guessing and rumination when it's clear things haven't changed a bit. How to tell intermittent reinforcement from real change? By looking at what's happened realistically and paying attention to whether or not you're reading in. One occasional moment that seems promising doesn't foretell a trend. Questions to ask yourself. Has the person really changed tacks, or is he or she simply less derisive, less withholding than usual? What exactly is different about the person's treatment of you? Be sure that it's not your optimism or hopefulness kicking in and making you upbeat for no reason. Are you ready to talk to the person directly about his or her behavior and to discuss the kinds of changes you'll need to see if the relationship is to go forward? If you're not ready, then you are effectively deciding to stay on the merry-go-round. Simply recognizing how intermittent reinforcement can keep you stuck is a step toward disarming it. Getting a handle on rumination. Did you know that the brain actively searches for unfinished business and works to counteract any efforts you make at subverting unwanted thoughts? That's exactly what Daniel Wegener discovered when he wanted to tackle the question of why, when we try not to think of something, it ends up being all we can think about. The answer has a fancy name, ironic processes of mental control, but it comes down to this. Your brain searches for the very thought you're trying to suppress. In one experiment, Wegener and other researchers told participants not to think about white bears while they were performing a task. Do appreciate the fact that most of us don't spend a lot of our time thinking about white bears most days, So the fact that those who were told not to think about them thought about them once a minute is quite something. In another experiment, participants were first instructed to think about white bears and then not to think about them. Guess what? They thought about them more when they were told not to. Avoiding a specific thought seems to have a priming effect. Yikes. So if you, like many of us, find yourself up in the middle of the night stewing and second-guessing about that last run-in with your mother or someone else, keep in mind that those ironic processes are out to destroy your every effort to stop thinking about her or him. You might want to register the fact that rumination can also feed into self-criticism, that habit of mind that ascribes failures to flaws in your character rather than events. So, how to stop this particular merry-go-round from spinning? Science shows that while distraction doesn't work, concentrated focus on something that really absorbs your interest does. Planning in detail, whether that's the garden bed you want to dig, the redecorating and repainting of the kitchen you want to do, or even a strategy for how you're going to handle emotional conflict in the future, can stop the white bears in their tracks. In a paper called Setting Free the Bears, Dr. Wegner suggests other strategies as well. Use positive focused visualization to calm yourself. Assign yourself a worry time. To be honest, I don't think this would work for me, but it does work for other people. Book a time to worry, say 20 minutes, and focus on everything that's bothering you. Invite the white bears in. This is the technique I found the most useful. It involves confronting those worries and worst-case scenarios that have been keeping you up and driving you mad, forcing yourself to confront them, seeing what would actually happen if they came to pass, and what you can do about them if they do, pushes worry out of the shadows and into the light where you can use slow thinking to figure things out. If you have close and trusted intimates with whom you can discuss these scenarios, it really helps to hear yourself clearly, all the better. Rumination keeps us stuck and prevents us from acting. It's as simple as that. And if you can stop the merry-go-round and begin to plan and set goals for yourself, you will make real progress. The downside to focus. Yes, I know that culturally we praise people who are able to focus and persist, but the truth is that it all depends on what they're focusing on and whether, as the old saw has it, they're missing the forest for the trees. It's one of the few adages that actually incorporates some psychological truth. This information is especially pertinent for those of you who are anxiously attached and tend to be vigilant and focused on details as a way of directing your behaviors. In addition to wrongly believing that memory is like a photograph, rather than the patched-together quilt of details that it is, we also like to think of ourselves as having panoramic vision, a capacity for seeing the big picture as well as the small detail. Well, that turns out not to be true, as an experiment conducted by Daniel J. Simmons and Christopher Chabris showed, published in a paper wittily called Gorillas in Our Midst. They later wrote a book as well, titling it The Invisible Gorilla. They had participants watch a video of people playing basketball and told them to either count the dribbles or the passes, thus forcing them to focus on a single detail. The video lasted 2 minutes, and about halfway through, a student in a gorilla costume walked into the middle of the game, thumped her chest, and exited. The researchers asked participants to report the number of bounces or passes, and then asked about the gorilla. Only half of them saw it. That is the downside to focus. More experiments followed, and they all showed that when we're focused on the detail, more than half of us will miss something important. This process is called inattentional blindness, and it underscores that our brains are not reliable in the way we think. There are just too many details for our eyes to take in, so the brain fills in for us, and sometimes, we end up missing the forest for the trees. Inattentional blindness affects all of us, but since you're on a voyage of self-discovery, ask yourself the following questions. Am I counting passes and dribbles in my relationship rather than looking at patterns of connection? Am I able to see the bigger picture when I think about my relationships, focusing on the abilities of close others to respond to me and meet my needs, or do I tend to get stuck analyzing and reanalyzing specific quarrels or disagreements? Do I only think about my relationships in times of stress? If so, how does that affect my focus and ability to see clearly? Am I able to see myself clearly when I think about my role in relationships, or do I get bogged down by focusing on what was said and done to me? Troubleshooting your emotional intelligence. Two important consequences of negative childhood experiences are the lack of support for the development of emotional intelligence and the presence of dynamics that actively impair it. It's not unusual, by the way, to discover that you have deficiencies in all four branches, especially if your childhood experiences required you to actively deny your feelings. Similarly, if you had to squelch your feelings in order to keep the peace or minimize fractiousness, you're not likely to have easy access to them now, nor will you have the appropriate skill set for managing them. Children who were subjected to continuous gaslighting also have specific deficits, not believing or trusting their feelings, which have to be addressed. Self-doubt, which all unloved daughters suffer from in one degree or another, also undercuts the ability to recognize and manage negative feelings. Samantha, 47, shared her childhood experience, which will be familiar to many. Being emotional was frowned upon by both parents. Being strong was never showing what you were feeling. My mother and father mocked me and my brother for crying, and I was picked on for feeling too sad too often. Yes, they both told me that they'd give me a reason to be sad if I didn't quit it. As an adult, I don't always know what I am feeling. Sad and angry seem to blend, and both make me feel ashamed. Weird, isn't it? The good news is that studies show that emotional intelligence is a skill set and can be built upon and improved. So take a personal inventory and ask yourself these questions. How adept am I at recognizing my feelings? Some situations in life prompt emotional responses that are relatively straightforward, and in these cases, labeling what we're feeling isn't very challenging. Your beloved pet dies, and waves of sadness wash over you. But more complicated events, a fight with your spouse or close friend, or a massive and very public failure in your work life, may evoke a range of different emotions, either sequentially or in simulcast, or a blend of feelings. In these situations, identifying your feelings requires the kind of dexterity that a game of pickup sticks does. You need to label and identify your different feelings in the moment. Do I oversimplify when I think about emotion? A study conducted by Lisa Feldman Barrett and her colleagues found that people who think about their emotions on a simple continuum with good and pleasant on one end and bad and unpleasant on the other, thus differentiating among them in broad strokes without nuance, had much more trouble managing their feelings. Is this you? Do I back off from thinking about feelings or emotional situations? It's been suggested that motivation may also be tied to poor emotional differentiation. People who are made uncomfortable by their emotions and are motivated to avoid emotional situations tend not to be able to differentiate their feelings very well, as a study by Yasmin Urbis and others showed. On the other hand, people who recognize that they're not good at labeling and identifying their emotions may actually want to approach emotional situations in the hope of improving their skills. This result led Urbis and her team to conclude that volition and motivation have a lot to do with your ability to differentiate your feelings. The importance of naming your feelings. It turns out that labeling your emotions, putting your feelings into words, actually causes physiological changes to a part of the brain, the amygdala, literally tamping down reactivity, as an MRI study by Matthew D. Lieberman showed. So, ask yourself these key questions. Do I avoid talking about my feelings? Does talking about my feelings make me anxious or uncomfortable? How good am I at making fine distinctions, such as realizing that I'm more ashamed than embarrassed or frustrated instead of angry? What's my response to emotionally complex situations? Am I able to untangle all of my various feelings and recognize their source, or do I just shut my brain off? Do I see the big picture? When someone asks what I'm feeling, am I able to answer? Do I avoid being specific about what I'm feeling on purpose, or is it a question of not knowing what I'm feeling? How hard is it for me to say, I'm angry, or I love you? Is one easier than the other? The question of emotional clarity. It's not just how skilled you are at differentiating your emotions. What matters, too, is how much emotional clarity you possess. What is emotional clarity? It's an enhanced or greater ability to identify, discriminate between, and understand the type of effect, e.g., anger versus frustration, and source of effect one typically experiences. While this sounds like emotional differentiation, it's actually a bit different, since this is a skill associated with reflection as opposed to labeling and identifying in the moment. One research study by Matthew Tyler Bowden and others found that the two skills were not just different, but unrelated. While being able to distinguish your feelings with accuracy will guide your behavior, realizing you were frustrated and not angry will lead you to apologize to the unwitting target of your hissy fit, understanding what kinds of events yield different emotions and outcomes, seeing the big picture, will give you more control over your choices and actions. For the unloved daughter, the big picture is the emerging portrait of your childhood and how your behaviors were formed in response to the way you were treated. As you become clearer about what happened, you will also be able to see triggers and echoes in your responses. Becoming conscious of outsized reactions that are reflections of the past, words that remind you of things your mother says or said, being put down in a familiar way, being told that the problem lies with you, is key to honing your ability to disarm the old patterns and begin to live differently. Questions to ask yourself. Am I a skilled emotional manager? If you're pretty sure that you're not, start practicing stop, look, listen. You need to focus on whether negative emotions insinuate themselves into your life, throw you into a ruminative loop, and end up internalized. If so, the likelihood is that you're state-oriented, or not as good at managing your emotions as you need to be. On the other hand, if negative emotions are something you can cope with, not by brushing them off, but by dealing with them in the day-to-day, the likelihood is that you're action-oriented. Coping skills are key to both achievement and satisfaction, and understanding how well you cope is critical. If you're prone to emotional flooding, use self-calming techniques, such as visualizing a supportive person, to stop the cascade. If you tend to wall yourself off, visualize a calming environment to stay emotionally open and permit yourself to feel your emotions. Do I have a bead on my moods? Moods affect each and every one of us. They impact how well we manage our emotions, as anyone can attest. Get to the office in a bad mood and just see how a minor irritant can escalate into major drama. Unlike emotions, which have an identifiable source or cause, I'm happy because I got a raise, or I'm sad because I messed up my presentation, moods are much more diffuse, harder to think about and to pinpoint. Becoming conscious of your moods and their effect on your actions and reactions is another way of honing your emotional intelligence skills. Engage in quiet self-reflection and focus on what is causing you to feel the way you do. Understanding moods is also key to effective forecasting. Recognizing your cloudy crystal ball. One specific area of reactivity is your anticipation of future events and how you prepare for them emotionally and psychologically. This could be a discussion you're going to have, a party or meetup you plan on attending, or even a move you're preparing for, such as a new job or a new place to live. Not surprisingly, unconscious processes play a role in shaping these responses too. It turns out that all humans, whether our needs are met in childhood or not, aren't very good at predicting how we'll act and feel in the future. Yes, once again, the securely attached have an edge over the insecurely attached, but understanding this human shortcoming will be helpful as you work on disarming triggers and move toward reclaiming your life. How good are you at anticipating your future reactions? How skilled are you at predicting how happy something will make you or, for that matter, how unhappy you'll be? This skill is what the experts call effective forecasting. Psychologists Timothy Wilson and Daniel Gilbert determined that effective forecasting has four distinct parts. 1. Our ability to predict whether our feelings will be positive or negative. 2. Our ability to predict the specific emotions we'll experience. 3. Our ability to predict how intense those feelings will be. 4. Our ability to predict how long those feelings will last. Not surprisingly, most of us are pretty good at the first, figuring out whether we'll feel great or dreadful when a future event takes place. But that's where most people's success rate starts and stops. Again, your emotional intelligence is going to factor in for the second part. Some people are better at identifying emotions with precision than others, but generally, people oversimplify when they think about what they'll feel in the future. Why is that? Few things in this life ever deliver emotions that are pure with no shade of gray, even apparently joyous events such as a wedding, a graduation, or a birth. May also evoke unanticipated feelings, such as loss or anxiety. Some examples. You're thrilled for your friend who's getting married, but you worry about how your relationship with her will change. You've graduated and are happy, but you're also feeling angsty about what's next. The new baby is delicious, and you're delirious with happiness, but you're also worried about how well you'll parent. Our thinking about the future is both more simplified and more black and white than what life actually presents. Humans also fall prey to what experts call the impact bias. Basically, we overestimate how future events, both good and bad, will affect us emotionally. We honestly believe that something good, getting the dream job, finishing school, moving to a new house, will lock in happiness forever. Thanks to what's called either the hedonic treadmill or the happiness set point, the new thing that seemed to promise eternal happiness becomes, rather quickly, something we're used to and thus stops making us happy. The dream job becomes the job you go to 5 days a week. Graduating gives you what to do next, and the house is where you live. Predictably, as we get used to positive changes, the intensity of feeling diminishes and our happiness fades. That's the bad news. But there's good news as well. The impact bias operates when bad things happen too, and as a result, we recover from setbacks that we were once sure we could never come back from. We misjudge not just the depths of the misery we're going to experience, but also how long the misery will last. That's largely a function of what Wilson and Gilbert call our psychological immune system, which permits us to make sense of or rationalize bad things when they happen unexpectedly. This, too, happens unconsciously. There's not much you can do about the impact bias except to know that it's there and factor it in, because the chances are good that whatever you're looking forward to or dreading isn't going to be either as good or as bad as you think. But if you want to get better at predicting your emotional state, some troubleshooting is called for. Wilson and Gilbert have pinpointed the most common sources of forecasting errors, a list from which we can all benefit. Your imagined anticipation of what will happen is an epic fail. Technically, this is called misconstrual, and the bottom line is that we're not likely to be anywhere close to predicting how we feel if the reality of what happens is completely different from what we imagined. You're sure that the vacation to Corfu will make you 1,000% happier, but you didn't factor in the 15-hour delay at the airport, the lousy weather, or your stolen wallet. Your focus is wrong. This is called framing, and it happens when we focus on a detail that we believe will influence our feelings, but doesn't. You move, and you're sure you'll feel happier not dealing with your oh-so-nosy and invasive neighbor. But then you find your neighbors at your condo unwelcoming. You hadn't planned on that. Your expectations are either too high or too low. The easiest example is the movie or novel everyone is touting and you're really looking forward to loving it. Not. Obviously, this can equally apply to anything you're anticipating. You're misled by your current mood. This is pretty obvious once you know about it. Our mindset at the time affects our thinking about the future. The best antidote to this forecasting error is being aware of the mood you're in and making sure your ability to perceive your emotions, yes, that's emotional intelligence again, is working optimally. Loss aversion, sunk costs, and getting stuck. Culturally, we put a high premium on staying the course, persistence, and grit, and we tend to be dismissive of those who quit or give up. That's why you're more likely to be surrounded by people who believe that winners never quit and quitters never win, even though you're actually struggling with letting go. The truth? The deck. Yes, the unconscious processes that drive the car that is you and everyone else is totally stacked in favor of hanging in, even when it makes us feel lousy. We can all thank evolution for that, and yes, I am being ironic. Humans are famously conservative, preferring to avert possible loss even when considering potential gain, as the work of psychologists Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman showed, earning a Nobel Prize in economics for the latter. Moreover, when we contemplate change, we're likely to frame the discussion in terms of what we already have invested instead of the possible gains we might reap from moving on. Focusing solely on our investment, which could be time, money, energy, gets in the way whether we're thinking about leaving a marriage, another relationship, a job, or even selling a clunker car we've repaired again and again. The fancy name for this habit of mind is the sunk cost fallacy, and we all do it. It's called a fallacy because the investment made is long gone and can't be recouped by either staying or leaving, but that doesn't stop us from thinking this way. It prevents us from looking forward. The only answer, again, is conscious awareness of your automatic thought processes. Ask yourself the following questions. Do I worry a lot about time wasted or spent? Is what's keeping me in place my investment or my real desire? Am I able to see beyond where I find myself and into the future? How afraid of loss am I? Which possible losses worry me most? Cueing into your rejection sensitivity. Being overly sensitive to rejection, as reviewed earlier, can also become a destructive, self-fulfilling prophecy, especially if you are very reactive or combative when you perceive either a slight or the hint of possible rejection. It's hard to disarm that hypervigilance, especially if it's what protected you in your family of origin, but it can be done. Again, the path to disarming is built on conscious awareness. Use the stop, look, listen technique if you find yourself suddenly tense with anticipation that someone is actively pushing you away or about to exclude you. Use self-calming techniques, such as visualization, to get yourself on more emotionally stable ground as quickly as you can. Once you've begun to relax a bit, ask yourself the following questions. Am I reading into what he or she said? Am I taking the words out of context? Am I mistaking banter for seriousness or otherwise misunderstanding the speaker's tone? What exactly was the speaker's intention? Can I tell? Can I stop myself from reacting and simply ask what he or she meant? More advanced strategies will be detailed in the next chapter. Tackling self-criticism. Becoming aware of your habit of self-criticism, ascribing the things that go wrong in life to your innate character flaws or characteristics, rather than errors in judgment, simple mistakes, or complicated and hard-to-read circumstances, is central to the process of disarming. Most of the time, this internalized voice echoes that of your mother or the other family members who derided or mocked you and made you feel inadequate and never good enough, no matter what you did. If constant criticism or derision was part of the daily fare, the reality is that you may employ this kind of thinking without even being conscious that you are. Yes, it's part of how children normalize their experiences so as to be able to get through them. Self-criticism sounds like this. I didn't get the promotion because I'm just not smart enough. The relationship failed because there's nothing lovable about me. I will never make anything out of my life because I'm nothing but a failure as a human being. No wonder everything went wrong, because I'm not capable of doing anything right. Is this you? Ask whether your own impulse is to blame yourself or to attribute failure to your flaws when things go south, because this, too, is learned behavior and may be an extension of self-criticism. Alternatively, you may also duck personal responsibility and be unwittingly quick to pin blame on others. Attribution involves finding a cause or reason for the untoward and, sometimes, being content that there's no reason at all and accepting that stuff just happens. Blaming is about finding someone to pin the bad stuff on. If you were raised in an environment where the blame game was always played, your reaction may be unconscious and automatic. Let's say the family car was vandalized one night while it was parked in the driveway and the windshield smashed. Parent number one is angry about the windshield, but writes the incident off as an unlucky encounter with random neighborhood thugs. Incident over. In another household, parent number two has to blame someone. It turns out that Nancy was the last kid to come home and she didn't leave the porch light on, so the vandals had the cover of darkness. In the telling, it now becomes Nancy's fault that the car was vandalized. Does this sound familiar? Ask yourself the following questions. When things go wrong, how important is it that someone be blamed or punished? How sensitive to criticism am I? How often do I overreact? Am I able to tell the difference between criticism that is meant to be constructive and criticism that is meant to diminish me? Disarming the self-critical voice. Recognizing the voice is the very first step, and you move on and out from there. Next, you need to begin to talk back to the voice. And yes, some people actually do this literally. Speaking aloud with other explanations for why something has gone awry or failed. You may not want to do this in a public place. Generally, talking to yourself in this way draws a fair amount of unwelcome attention. Using your journal to analyze a situation or event, discovering why things went wrong or ended badly if they did, or why your expectations weren't met, is another way of establishing a different pattern of response. We'll examine specific strategies in the next chapter. Your personal default settings. While it's possible to draw generalizations, valuable ones as it happens, about our experiences and the effects of an unloving mother's behaviors, each of our experiences has elements that are unique and individual. Spend time thinking about which of the unconscious processes reviewed in this chapter constitute your own personal default settings. With that information in hand, you'll be able to develop effective strategies for learning new behaviors. You may well discover that things about yourself that you considered personality traits, the way you hesitate, your fearfulness, even your tendency to procrastinate, are actually responses to your childhood experiences. In the next chapter, we'll be looking at precisely how you can reclaim the power to live the best life you possibly can. Chapter 7. Reclaiming Your Power. For me, the continuing challenges are shutting off the critical voice in my head that stops me from doing anything that seems vaguely challenging because I'm sure I'll fail, and the problem of not trusting anyone. I always think people are out to trip me up. Anna, 41. While it's true that all of us felt powerless in our childhoods, and many continue into adulthood, we're ready to start reclaiming our authentic selves once we have gone through the processes of discovery, discernment, distinguishing, and disarming. We can thank the magical power of the brain, yes, that very same brain that can sometimes lead us down the garden path, because of its changeability, which is more literal than not. This chapter focuses on the changes you can make, starting now, to how you manage your emotions, use your emotions to inform your thoughts, set goals for yourself, choose the company you keep, and live your life. Every strategy offered is founded in science, much of it behavioral. Some of what you'll be hearing will run counter to what you've heard elsewhere, why you should give up on affirmations, for example, or how positive thinking can set you back. But I'd like you to give me the benefit of the doubt and, more important, have what science knows be part of your arsenal going forward. Let's start with the things you have to stop doing. The big question you have to stop asking. If there is a single question that hangs over an unloved daughter's life, it's certainly this one. Why doesn't my mother love me? And, understandably, for almost all of us, finding the answer becomes a search no different from the knight seeking the Holy Grail. Why is that? Because a definitive answer would help make sense of what happened at your house and to you, and maybe offer up the magic formula that could allow you to fix everything, as one woman wrote me. I thought that if I knew why she didn't love me, I could somehow change the unlovable parts of me, and then she would love me. Mind you, I was still thinking this way in my 40s, long after I became a mother myself. But the impulse to make sense of what's happened also can easily become another cycle of justification, rationalization, and normalization on the daughter's part, one that keeps the music ever playing for the dance of denial. Yes, there's an aha moment when you read a self-help book or an article and you decide your mother's a narcissist or has borderline personality disorder and you breathe a sigh of relief because now you think you know why she shunned or shamed you. Here's the problem. With that supposed answer in hand, you think you're getting closer to resolving and understanding your childhood experiences. But the reality is that the answer doesn't move you forward at all. Why? Because your focus remains on her when it should be on you. It's for that reason that I ask you to stop asking the question and stop looking for the answer. You have to stay focused on how you adapted to her treatment and how you can give up the behaviors you unconsciously took on and exchange them for new ones. Why she did what she did isn't your concern. You are your main concern. Asking the question reinforces your false belief that there's a definitive answer, which there isn't. Mothers don't love for many reasons, or none at all. But each possible answer only reflects her. It was never about you, so please, stop asking. I know it's hard not to ask, but it's something you must do. Say no to positive thinking. I'm not asking you to throw out those inspirational magnets and mugs, the ones that say things like every cloud has a silver lining or what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But I do want you to put them away for the moment. Yes, I know the cultural wisdom advocates coping with disappointment and pain by looking at the bright side. But the truth is that positive thinking isn't actually always good for you. Let me explain why positive thinking should be off the table, especially when dealing with the special circumstances an unloved daughter confronts. Humans are hardwired for over-optimism anyway. It's called the optimism bias, and it basically means that we are inclined to think that bad things will happen to us and those close to us less often than they will happen to other people, and that, conversely, good things will be more likely to happen to us than the average person. This is true even if you are a glasses-half-empty person and inclined toward pessimism. First noted by psychologist Neil Weinstein in 1980, it's been looked at different ways over the years. Needless to say, it feeds right into the dance of denial and other tactics unloved daughters adopt when dealing with the core conflict. A fascinating experiment, detailed in 2012 by Taylor Sherritt and others, demonstrated that there is actually a location in the brain for the optimism bias, the left inferior frontal gyrus, IFG. Negative information, they posited, is processed by the right IFG. When they delivered intracranial magnetic stimulation to the left IFG, thus disabling study participants' founts of optimism, they were able to demonstrate that people were more apt both to let in negative information and to pay attention to it. Unloved daughters, especially those who are still hopeful that somehow the crisis can be resolved, are very vulnerable to using positive thinking to override the realistic appreciation of the circumstances they find themselves in. The takeaway: positive thinking can stop you from being realistic about your circumstances and get in the way of the emotional work you have to do. Optimism feeds the illusion of control. This one is really interesting and unexpected. Humans are loaded with cognitive biases, including the tendency to credit our successes to our own actions and to attribute our failures to outside sources or situations beyond our control. But did you know that being a bit down in the mouth about our prospects may actually stand us in good stead as an antidote to all that optimism? That's what a series of experiments conducted by Lauren B. Alloy and Lynn Y. Abramson found. Depressed subjects had a more accurate view of their own agency than non-depressed participants. When you curb your enthusiasm, along with your optimism, you can recognize that you're hardwired to connect dots that aren't actually connected. Inculcate some realism into how you view your actions and the progress you're making. It's also important that you become clear about which aspects of your life you can control and which you can't. Yes, the Serenity Prayer is right in calling that wisdom. Positive thinking can be a distraction from the work at hand. Thinking positively, reaching for that silver lining script or putting on those rose-colored glasses, not only skews our ability to assess situations critically, but also encourages us to avoid or distract ourselves from dealing with negative fallout. Whether your coping skills are largely anxious or avoidant, the last thing you should be doing is looking away from the difficulties at hand. Give up on affirmations and ask yourself questions instead. I personally have nothing against affirmations, but research shows that asking yourself, "Will I?" is far more effective and motivates you more than repeating, "I will do X or Y," again and